This is Kevin Clark and Steve Turley on How Beauty Teaches.
All right, gang, come on in. All right. Or as the Germans would say, kommen Sie hier, Kinder. All right, we're going to begin the section on How Beauty Teaches. Steve and Kevin are going to be leading us in this session. I was just talking to Melody on the way up. We were talking about how often in our schools we teach to the analytical side of our human students so much that we can end up suppressing their intuitive, wondering side. And we can suppress their inclination to wonder and to gaze at things that are good, true, and beautiful. Our grammar school kids kind of come in with that built-in ability, and sometimes we end up squelching it over time. So these two gentlemen are going to be touching on that theme, how beauty actually teaches. Steve has taught aesthetics. Kevin has taught aesthetics. Steve has taught it both at the high school and the college level. He teaches aesthetics at Eastern College. And Kevin's been teaching, in addition to other subjects, aesthetics at Geneva for some time. So they've been collaborating a little bit, and they're going to lead us in a presentation and discussion. We have a prayer. Lord, we pray that you would bless this particular session and open our eyes, give us increased wisdom. Help us to be, as we're clarifying philosophy, to be thinking immediately to practical implications as well in our schools and classrooms. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Is this okay?
Symbol.
Well,
I thought a good way to start, actually. Yesterday, I could just totally spring this on you, Steve, if you want to do this. Yesterday, when you ended the more directed part of your presentation and we descended upon you with questions, we focused more on trying to trace out certain elements of ecclesiology that were more peripheral to your main point. And I was wondering if maybe just for a few minutes you might want to put down a little bit of a framework of what you're saying about how classical education was taken, transformed, became part of the fabric of a Christian understanding of raising children.
Oh, okay. Well,
particularly when you talked about the transcendentals in nature, the experience of those sorts of things, the acquisition of virtue, paideia, the polis. Maybe you just maybe put some of this stuff on a map.
Yeah,
for us,
we did. Well, what we were doing when a lot of people left, but there was a bunch of us that kind of stuck around, is I gave a chart that I use for my students to help map out basically. An ancient worldview, and now this may be a bit reductionist, but I think it's pretty good. It tends to work, and it helps us then to begin to analyze beauty and analyze how and analyze the visions of truth and goodness that are communicated through particular experiences of beauty. And then this can help you with students. You know, it came up, for example, one of the questions that was asked is, okay, well, you know, if a student asks you, is it okay to listen to this kind of music, what do you say? Is it okay to, piercings? Is it okay for a tattoo? Is it okay to, it's a biased question. Is it okay? Is it all right? You know, that kind of stuff. And so this is a neat way of being able to think aesthetically about the situation. And for the ancients, more or less, again, this is just a general framework. They begin with something called telos. And telos is the goal, it's the purpose, it's the integrity of the created order. It's embedded in the created order. And if you remember the macro-micro relationship, that telos that's in the created order is also evident within us. So, you know, when you hear John Lennox talking about sort of the specified complexity, you know, in the DNA and how physical natural processes cannot give rise to this kind of information. In other words, the information in us and the information in the cosmos have a common link. We're all participants in this grand, informative, intellectual, symmetrical cosmos. And telos would be the ancient word for it, the goal, the purpose, the integrity. Telos is made up of truth, goodness, and beauty as basic categories. Now again, no Greek is doing this, by the way. This is our own systematization here. Truth, goodness, and beauty. Truth holds the world together. Goodness is the oughtness of the world being held together. It would be very interesting to explore the moral dimensions of the information entailed in the cosmos. That would be very interesting to explore. There's a moral entailment to truth. If something is true, it ought to be believed. We're obligated to believe it, as it were. And then beauty is the loveliness, the delightfulness, the delectableness, the allure, the effulgence, the radiance of the true and the good that has the goal, the telos of drawing us to the true and the good, awakening a desire for the true and the good. Now you got to get that. If you've got that, then you've got a grammar for beauty. Beauty awakens desire, awakens the desire for something, and you have to catch that. It awakens a desire for something, because that would be really important when you start asking questions to your students. Okay. And then, truth, goodness, and beauty being sort of ethereal, abstract concepts, get embodied, they get substantiated in what? Culture, right? Culture, I'm basically a culturist. I see culture, and again, this is a definition, but I think pretty good for classical world. It is the substantiation, it's the embodiment, it's the making palpable telos. And so what do I mean by culture? Well, we can start with music, art, what else, right? Family, economics, science, clothing, etc., right? Politics.
Just take T.S. Eliot's definition, the total harvest of thought and feeling.
There you go. Same kind of idea. And then what holds it all together? What gives some kind of sense of coherence, some unified theme? Because there's going to be a unified theme, even in our crazy world today. There's going to be a unified theme. What holds it all together? Ritual and religion. And even religion itself is a bit of a modernist term. So I do mean ritual, religion, in other words, that which gives us a direct encounter with telos, and it awakens what Emile Durkheim called effervescence within the human person, uniting the soul. That's me. Okay? If you're going to have culture, you've got to have cult. Cult is what's going to hold the culture together. Now that's the basic framework for understanding the frames of reference by which we live life. It's a helpful one, let's put it that way. So now you get asked a question. Is it okay to listen to such and such kind of music? Well, what's the simple questions you could start asking? Very good. Very good. What is the culture that this music is embodying? Which means I'm asking what? What is its vision of the beautiful, the good, and the true? What is it? Now, in order to dissect that, again, I go to cultural anthropology for this, because it's helpful, really, bottom line, in the end, because it gives a nice heuristic way of approaching this. If you go to cultural anthropology, you can come up with something called a cognized hierarchy, a cognized environment of what we would call the moral imagination, or just the imagination in general. And I use Roy Rappaport, who's one of the premier cultural anthropologists, American cultural anthropologists. And he identifies more or less, it's actually five, but I use four structures to the imagination. Again, just a neat way of being able to organize taxonomically, as it were, your questions. What he does is he puts them in a hierarchy. He starts with what's called ultimate sacred postulates. Every culture has one. Evolution would be one, for example. Or, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. An ultimate sacred postulate would be almost equivalent to Vantillian presuppositional. These are the postulated beliefs, propositions, and so forth upon which the totality of one's belief system is founded. Beyond argument. He goes so far as to say, I think it's quite neat. Generally speaking, they're going to be unverifiable and unfalsifiable. They're going to be scientifically unverifiable, and they're going to be rationally unfalsifiable, and hence they're absolutely certain. That's pretty cool, if you think of it. They're absolutely certain. See, we go the other way. We're modernists. If you can't prove it, then, you know.
Certainty comes by faith.
Exactly. And it's a faith that's encountering a real world. But it's autonomous. So here, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. They're really, outside of Israel, and even technically Israel, there's nothing tangible about that statement, right? I believe in God the Father Almighty. You know, there's nothing tangible. But that's where it all begins. Ultimate sacred postulates. So right away, you can start filling in these questions. Is it okay to listen to his music? Well, here's the question. You're attracted to it, obviously. You wouldn't be asking the question. Okay, so what does this music consider sacred? What does it consider sacred? What are its sacred postulates? What are its non-negotiables? And they are non-negotiables. Okay, if you can negotiate them, they ain't sacred, right? They ain't set apart from the, you know, skeptical and entropic processes of life. Then he lists what are called cosmological axioms. I have an easy way of remembering this book, but I'll just give them to you for. Cosmological axioms then are, that's where we get into what Robbie's been talking about, when we were talking about beauty the other day. This is the nature of the cosmos. A cosmos is always going to come out of your sense of the sacred. The sacred begins to inform your cosmos. So, of course, then the next question is, what do they believe about the cosmos? What are they saying about the world in which we live? Then, the third would be community. What is this community? Remember micro, macro? What is this worldview, what does this belief system say about community, about population, about humans, about what we are as a people group? And then finally, ethics. Put it over here. How should we live? How should we act? What are we obligated to? That kind of idea. Now, he has some extras, but that's a nice little structure. And if you want a simple little alliteration, you've got creed, cosmology, community, and conduct. And so you take, let's have fun, take Lady Gaga. All right.
There you go.
Now, is it all right to listen to Lady Gaga? All right. So that's my question, and I deal with it. And then I push the students. I said, all right, you've seen Lady Gaga videos, right? Right? Because remember, music is not just listened to anymore. As Grant's going to get into a bit today in a different... Right? So listen, it's seen. You see music today.
I was just with a friend in L.A. who's got a 5-record deal with Universal, and he said, music is now taken in through the eyes.
You got it. That's brilliant. That is too cool.
That's what makes Pearl Jam so good. They refused to do videos.
Oh, there you go. Okay, all right. I didn't know there was an implied premise. That's what they are so good on.
It's like, dude. There were just some things we should have talked about.
There you go. All right. So anyway, they're bucking the trend there. All right. So you can go.
They're also not making any money.
They're okay with that.
All right. So you go to a Lady Gaga video. Has everybody seen a Lady Gaga video? I don't know why I pick on Lady Gaga. There you go. Sure, we're just watching last night. We're having a... we were up very, very late.
Raise your hand, you must leave now.
That's right. We've weeded them out. All right, now you can start asking questions, and I'll do it to you. If you guys are a bit familiar, if you're not, just, you know, think of the most bizarre person you can think of, and then...
start from there.
But, all right, what does Lady Gaga think about the sacred? What's sacred? Yeah. And I disagree.
Her.
I'm just, good. Why? Okay. How do you know?
Because she's the focal point of everything.
How do you know that visually?
Well, in her videos, everything is Gaga-centric.
You got it. You got it. I had a student, I did this, a student said this. I said, have you ever seen this video? Yeah, what does she hold sacred? I guess herself. Why? Because she's always at the center of the screen. And everything revolves around. Everything, every person, every animal, everything revolves around Lady Gaga. Okay? I said, all right, good. So the sacred is the self. The sacred, okay, that's cool. What does it say about the cosmos? What is her cosmos?
It revolves around her. The iconography in the Made This Way video is absolutely religious. It's totalizing. Everything comes out of her. Everything revolves around her. It's all about her own multivalent sexualities.
You got it.
And notice in the moral self-justification, I'm made this way. Don't judge me. I'm made this way. I'm made this way.
There you go.
And then what about this?
For a community of one.
You got it.
Which is not
it's relatively irrelevant. It's a community that affirms me and affirms the self. Do you see, if you did this with Bach, you're not going to get that. Do you see that? Isn't that interesting? You're not going to get that. What are we doing? We're dissecting telos. That's what we're doing. We're dissecting telos. Okay? We had the encounter, and now we're stepping back and we're building an epistemology. We're building a way of knowing our world. That's very cool. Because if you think it through, all of these things can be forged and formed via the incarnation. Jesus Christos Kyrios. Jesus Christ is Lord. What does it say about the cosmos? The resurrection has begun. The eighth day is here. The new creation is here. What does it say about community? There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave or free, male or female. What about ethics? Now we embody the fact that the entirety of the cosmos is being incorporated in the transformative life, death, and resurrection of Christ through the same awakening of love that is the incarnation itself. Is that Lady Gaga? So do you want to listen to it? Now, does this mean there's no telos in Lady Gaga? Of course not. There's plenty of telos in Lady Gaga. But is it good? Maybe some of it is. Maybe some. You can start breaking it down a bit visually. You can look at it technically. You can start looking from the eyes of American Idol, that kind of stuff. That's cool. You can move in there. No problem. But is this what you want? Do you want to be attracted to a world of the self? That glorifies the self, that has a cosmology that evolves out of the self, that makes community affirming of the self, and that creates an ethic where the self gets to actualize itself without any moral restraints whatsoever from outside. Is that what you want? You can have it if you want. Is that what you want? What you're doing is you're teaching them now to see telos in the totality of culture. Okay? You could do the same thing with piercings. You could do the same thing with tattoos. You could do the same thing with art, visual art, movies, you name it. You can begin looking, and we're just scratching the surface. I mean, we're going to get analysis today that can plumb the depths of this stuff. But that's a nice little gateway into entering into the way you can start analyzing culture. Cultures never lie. This is a really good point. Right? Atheists can be very, very ethical people. I think it was Doug Wilson who pointed this out. Atheists can be very, very ethical people, but atheistic cultures are hellholes. Cultures don't lie, so it's really neat to use culture as a means of analysis. And so you always so I never answer the student. I don't say, is it good, okay to listen to Lady Gaga? Why should I say no? I'll look at them and say, you tell me. You just told me what it is. You tell me. What do you think? You want it?
Interestingly enough, there's a couple questions. I'm interested. You're doing it kind of like you're dealing with these students who are critical. They're in, so they're thinking through these sorts of things. I'm interested in my classes a lot, where do these come from? Right, these are not naturally occurring aspects of the human soul. Right, we do these things naturally as human beings, but where do we get our ultimate sacred postulates?
whence derives our cosmological axia, our community, and our ethics. And, you know, interestingly enough, your student who asks, is it okay to listen to Lady Gaga, you know, being, well, there's obviously something that attracts me to this, so there's something that this student has in this category. There's a certain telos that they've, that they're actually taking part in that.
Yeah.
You know, actually, yes, yeah, so if I listen to it, like, yeah, well, no, I don't want to listen, but I mean, yes, I do want to listen to it, and I'm actually going to, and I want you to.
Sure, well, that's where you get that logos, ethos, pathos, you see. The pathos should be controlled by the logos, which evokes ethos. So your moral decisions, the ethos, are guided by.
Okay, now say that one again. Did you guys catch what he just said there? What's the order, right? So you're not saying the right thinking is going to lead to right feeling, which is going to lead to right.
No. The ideal is to have a unified soul that comes through ritual religion, and Lady Gaga is, as we just heard, radically religious.
Right.
All right. Again, the question of religion is. It's that is itself non-negotiable. Atheism is a religion. The question is whether you have a good one or a bad one.
Right.
Right? So, and 99.9% of them are really bad. Religions are hard. Religions are very difficult to put together. This is a hard thing to balance. And so, you know, it can look pretty impressive for a few decades or maybe even a century or two. But if it's like secularism, that'll implode. That's not a problem. So what you're talking about then is logos, ethos, pathos. The ideal, at least, is that the mind, the renewing of the mind, is able to produce, as it were, an ethos that is able to control a pathos. That's the idea. But they can't be abstracted from one another. They have to be coming together. That's why I find beauty a wonderful category. They have to be coming together in an encounter. And the encounter will awaken logos by awakening eros. It'll transform pathos into an eros, and in the Christian view, into an agape, into a love. That then is itself virtue, you know, faith working in love. So I see those three things being shaped by encounter. And then the reflection is really bottom, the epistemological reflection. It's very much similar to how biblical and systematic theology relate to it. The systematic reflection, then, is for the purpose of objectifying and articulating that experience in such a way to point others to it and to recognize a counterfeit.
Yeah, very interesting. I don't know if I have any fellow Dantistas in the room. Any big Dante fans? This is basically what he's telling you, right? Like, you travel through the inferno is metanoia, it's the changing of your mind.
Yeah.
Purgatory is the renewing of your will, to where finally Virgil can say to him in the entry to earthly paradise, "Now follow your love." Because your love will only be
forever. Right. It's the Platonic ascent. You know, you start solely with the perception, and then you move up to opinion. You know, then you get into understanding, and then full-blown reason for Plato is the union of the soul. It's not just rationality; it's the totality of logos, ethos, pathos working together in harmony and love.
So we're not at the threshold of the earthly paradise, and we have. I'm anticipating, questions here, and obviously we can't say let love be your guide to our students here, although they are being guided by loves. So you know, we ask the question: how does beauty teach? How do we form the ultimate sacred postulates, the cosmological axioms, the community? How do we have the right teleological orientation to where? Because I guess what your ideal is, you don't want somebody to say no, don't listen to Lady Gaga. It's to where they'd say, well, no, I don't want that.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's where. Again, I'm just giving a basic framework here. I mean, it gets deeper, obviously, with the book, right? But again, it's just a very practical sense. Yeah, if you're doing economics, if you're doing politics, if you're doing art, math, science, everything we heard today was that.
Right.
Everything. We're talking about the sacred, we're talking about the cosmos, we're talking about ethics, we're talking about what kind of society we're going to have. Everything is about that. So, but this just gives you a nice grid to structure your questions. And then you'll find it's very interesting because students, when you start pushing them on certain things, you could bring up gay marriage, for example. You bring up gay marriage, which I it's getting increasingly brought up at Eastern, which is kind of freaking me out here. I do exactly this. What does that presuppose about the sacred? And you know, they always say love, the sanctity of love. And I said, now, okay, what do you mean by that? What love? Well, the love that Jesus has for us. Well, what is that love? Talk to me about it. Let's do it. And eventually you have to get into, it's a Trinitarian love. Okay? Because that's fundamental to the Christian idea of the family. The only way you have Trinitarian love manifest in this creation, if you remember from yesterday, is what? How's Trinitarian love restored? Remember analogia entes? Right? Creation is... So the only way is if it is reawakened through the incarnation. If a bridegroom comes in and marries a bride, then you begin to see Trinitarian love come out again. And so what happens in classical Christian marriage, particularly developed in Byzantium, is the idea is that every time a man and a woman are brought together, heaven and earth are brought together, the incarnation is re-manifest again, and now the husband and wife can have a love that comes together that produces a third, and now they can image forth the Trinity.
This is a great mystery, but you speak of Christ in the church.
There you go. Yeah, Ephesians, there you go.
Well, I don't know if it gets us off track. I think it's confusing.
But can I say, just before you go, but I answered that question, and it always comes up, with beauty. I didn't say, because the Bible says that they're homos. You know, I didn't say, because Leviticus 18 says, which it does. But I answered it with beauty. I awakened their imagination. I said, think about what does family say about the sacred, about the true, the good, the beautiful. So if we're thinking in terms of beauty, we begin to awaken a moral imagination. You know, every student I tell that to never heard of that before. They never heard that. They think simply just, you know, having two people to come together because they love each other. How are they defining love? In terms of the self. Satisfaction of the self. So of course, why wouldn't I want two people to be happy? But then you got to kiss goodbye to the incarnation. And then, because if Christ had self-love, there would have been an incarnation.
And this is the interesting thing about this. I would say a person who's done a lot of work for me is, at least recently, is this historian of religions, Marcello Eliade.
Yeah, sure.
I'd say myth does this right here.
Yeah.
The stories we tell ourselves. What you know, where do the students get the narrative that love is sanctity? Because every single cultural artifact we have. Yeah. Every single bit of this is reinforcing the telos that tells you the love of two people, the disinterested, extracted from community, self-love of two people is the most important virtue.
Right.
And so, yeah, so of course, you know, I try this with my students in an ethics class and just, you know, play the devil's advocate. I'm not Irish like, you know, John Lennox, but, you know, just say, how dare you tell two people who love one another they can't be together?
Right.
You're a monster.
Right.
How could you do that? If you try that with yourself, I mean, you're back in those situations. How dare we say that people love one another, they can't do what they want to do?
How can you call love a sin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love can't be wrong. Right? And the power of that, just understanding we've a certain mythology, I mean, and not like in the sense like, oh, it's false, but like certain stories that we've told ourselves that we've all watched, right? Like all those episodes of whether it's been King of the Hill cartoons or, you know, watching our sitcoms, all of our music videos, huh? Friends. You know, all the pop songs that I can sing thousands of lyrics to thousands of songs, you know, to have reinforced this idea of what love is. And so, yeah, I told this story, and two of the guys here know it. I watched the movie Once. Have you guys seen this movie? Mm-hmm. Once. With a group of Christian friends, we were watching it. Everybody know what the movie is? Like, you know, well, I'll ruin it for you. It's an Irish film, right? An Irish film. And the kind of protagonist, these two main characters, it's I think a Polish immigrant, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. This young lady, she sells vacuums. She's estranged from her husband. This Irish man who's kind of a washed out musician, his fiance left him. Anyhow, she's a concert musician and helps get his career back together. They start making music, and then there's obviously the time where they fall in love, right? But they... they don't get together. Like, there's no sort of, coming together. Matter of fact, she said, no, this wouldn't be right. And you've been built up through your passions through the entire film. Like, you want these two people together, even though that would mean the woman would have to commit adultery. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking with some friends afterwards, and the one friend said, this is a terrible movie. They didn't get together. There was no, like, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after they said that, they went, oh, my goodness, I know that it's wrong, but yet what I want to happen is this. And it led to this discussion of, well, we have a script we're all reading from. It's a cultural script that's been written for us by our mythology.
Absolutely.
And so what I'll do in my classes is I'll focus a little bit more on the pre-critical foundations of these, they come from stories. They come from, interestingly enough, these things right here we can analyze from this side back, but this is where we encounter culture, and it actually forms these, which means...
Yeah, and it's a mystery. Yeah. Where you ask me where these come from. Yeah. You ask a cultural anthropologist, they evolve.
Yeah.
Okay. This is. I mean, this can be explained. Language is a problem. Language enables us to be human, but it also enables us to lie.
Right.
And enables us to speak different kind of languages. Enables us to say different things with the same words. So if we're going to have any kind of society, we have to have the word upon which all words are going to be judged. There you have ultimate sacred postulates. It's a natural process. And that word then in turn where language alienates us from nature. Right? We're the only things that speak. It's not good that man be alone. Right? But if you have a word upon which all other words can be understood, and that word is a sacred word that links you now with nature, with the sanctity of nature, now you can bridge that as well. And then your ethics, your community should reflect that macro-micro cosmology bridged together by this word, which ends up getting embodied by culture. So it comes out that way. I have no problem with that, other than I think that's precisely what comes, given the fact that we're created beings in the face of Coram Deo. And this is obviously the kind of stuff you're going to come with. Coram Deo. You had a question.
No. Is there Hegelian idealism working here?
No. No. Not even. Not even remotely. No.
Is there a priority here, though?
Nada.
Embodying?
Yes.
What's that?
Name.
No, because there's no thesis antithesis. You need a thesis antithesis.
Well, okay.
This is just a basic way of saying, look, there's no neutrality. Okay, it's just a basic way of saying, but at least you could start, all right, let's start dissecting this.
And I wasn't going to ask that question. You haven't sparked it, though, with your question, because what has priority, your thought and thought or practice, or are they always together and you don't want to pull them apart?
Well, it seems like what you're saying is like they're mutual.
The paracoretical, you can go there. I would tend to side with with Bourdieu. Some practice theorists that says in the end practice is you ride a bike first and you talk about it second. Practice is first. Yeah, exactly. You practice is first, and then you go back and you think about the practice, you articulate it, and then that inevitably often influences the practices. So it's not a zero sum game. It's not like Marxism where you're absolutely you're socially defined. There's a dynamism there, absolutely. Once I learn I'm a boy, once I learn, I've got parents and a family, I got a backyard, once I learn that, then I start making sense of that world, and then maybe I start moving things around.
I think that's what you were getting.
And then becoming my friend, realizing, oh my goodness, I'm operating, my emotive response to this film is operating off of a script. I don't want to believe with my mind, and so I'm going to try to reform my basic interaction with the symbols that are coming at me. Like, I don't want to believe that to be true, and I don't know if, a Marxist would be able to account for that. How could I be outside of my social
position? Right, right.
Just an observation on your schematic that I'm thinking about that conversation you would have with a student where you're helping them trace it back to the telos, right? Mm-hmm. With that, there's a sense in which if they don't recognize that what they're doing by listening to Lady Gaga is actually derivative of something, tracing it all the way back,
then there's a danger that in that diagram, they're going to come full circle back around, and unknowingly, through their cultural experiences, they're going to be redefining, through practice, what their telos is. So that is this notion that our participation in culture transforms or can transform our telos unknowingly, sometimes if we're not careful, right?
Absolutely.
And so there's a cyclical nature to it that I think is worth pointing out. It doesn't just trace linearly backwards. And then my observation back to...
That's Hegelian. The actual process to be conformed to the world.
Right.
Yeah, and so I want to point out to you that I see that's what there's probably numerous biblical examples of this cyclical nature, but for me it's best captured in that Romans 11:12 transition. Mm-hmm. Here's this doctrine that elicits this doxology, mm-hmm. and the 12th chapter begins with the transformation of the mind. Mm-hmm. Compelling somebody into a community where they're doing service.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the book doesn't end with chapter 12.
Right.
It keeps going.
Right.
And so we see this cycle in Scripture.
Right.
We're silly to pretend, what Christians will tend to do is they'll say, well, I can listen to Lady Gaga, even though I know I maybe shouldn't, because I can tolerate it for a time. It's like a little dose. Not recognizing the fact that even that participation and that experience is actually transforming our telos, whether we like it to or not.
Yeah, I can. Yeah. I don't know if I wouldn't go, I mean, I wouldn't say it's determinative. I'm just a little bit nervous whether we like it or not.
Far. I don't want to go that far either. So
I mean, in order to do this exercise, I watch Lady Gaga.
Yeah, we all have our
You know, and I mean, but yeah, she really is. Yeah, she really is.
No, you said Big Mac, too. That's a good example.
We all eat Big Mac, right? If I'm eating a Big Mac every meal, I'm going to have issues here, you know? Yeah, exactly. Supersize. Yeah, that kind of thing. But I think
the negative version of what you just pointed out is 11 chapters earlier, where after the opening of Romans 1, he launches into these stages of degradation where you suppress the truth and then you end up completely reversing God's plan for human beings to be able to reproduce the image of God by having children.
And notice too where it all began for Paul too.
Right.
You
just said Paul too,
team.
That made me think of the theology of the body. there you go. I know you meant Paul also.
JP too.
JP too would say.
I said Paul.
This is the culture of death, right? This is what he's talking about.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it begins in ritual, begins in religion. So in many respects, music is an extension of ritual, art is an extension of ritual, families are. And we have to take our liturgy seriously.
I just want to pick up on the past comments before you get going again, because I think they're really helpful. Because in your analysis, Gaga, the one thing I say, well, I wonder, I'd like to hear more about pathos. Because it sounds like you said a lot about logos, a lot about ethos. And then the community question, I would have answered a little bit differently. I would say there is a community between the subject and the object. I'm the voyeur. Lady Gaga is a voyeur.
That's cool. That's cool.
So that is that transaction is transforming me by entering into that community. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the study's been shown that said when people look at pornography, it reshapes their brain.
Yep, you bet.
And so that will entering into that ritual.
Yep.
Will change me. Now, of course, when you have critical distance, that helps. But I think it's useful if we're going to talk about this with our students. Is saying. This will physically change.
It will physically change.
Yeah. That's great.
If I can just a brief interjection on the issue of pornography. My father-in-law is a federal prosecutor and has had to prosecute a number of child pornographers. Really terrible stuff. But one of the things he learned about pornography is he said when men engage in pornography, it creates a false intimacy with lots of other women and a distance with their own wives. Talk about how it just destroys community. Have this kind of false intimacy with other women, and yet be losing intimacy where you need it most. Mm.
So
reverses, it's a reverse of blessing and it's a curse.
So does my 14-year-old niece then have an intimacy with Lady Gaga that she doesn't have with her friends?
Absolutely.
I think she does.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, this is one of the theory, I mean, leaving aside the pornography, why Oprah was so popular. She was everybody's best friend. The pathos I tend to leave out just simply because the whole conversation is an issue because of pathos. They like it. They're attracted to this, and they want to know, is that okay? Is it okay to be a... What's that?
It appeals to the religion.
Oh, absolutely. That's why encounter epistemology. Encounter. It's really neat. If you want to keep pulling the encounter epistemology and then reappraisal. Okay, do you want to go back and do it again? You know, kind of thing. So, and we all know, just because you know you probably shouldn't or whatever, you know, that doesn't mean you're not going to do it. But nevertheless, you at least begin the process of discernment.
And I know we all know this, but especially with younger children, I think, too, just the exposure issue, right, of exposing them to good things as opposed to...
That's exactly
I mean,
right.
I mean, Neil Postman talks about how the job of educators is to instill in children a crap detector.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there you go.
And it's really unbelievable to me how children, I mean, my own children at times and other children, right, that have been exposed to, for example, really great music. I mean, my six-year-old son, if he hears pop music, he'll say, like, this is not good music. Mm. And he doesn't know, right? But he can say, that's Tchaikovsky and that's Mozart.
Right.
And he knows, and there's something aesthetic about it that appeals by exposure to good things. I mean,
right.
I know we all know that. But,
right.
And I think that that's, you know, this is where that the circular aspect of addressing our logos, right? And knowing I shouldn't do that or I should do that. And sometimes it hurts, and sometimes it's difficult, and sometimes it's not enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
But as we lead our students to trudge through Shakespeare or whatever, right,
mm-hmm.
I think that there is an aspect in which hopefully the goal is, right, that the pathos is effective, right,
yeah,
such
absolutely.
That you approach
absolutely.
It, they realize, wow, I'm really drawn to
what
that.
What did John Ruskin say, right? The whole job of education is not to have kids just know righteousness, but to hunger and thirst for righteousness, right? Not to just know beauty, but to love beauty.
Right. You
know?
Aristotle said the whole purpose of education is to love what's lovely.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, the love is the TOS of education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the end, when all's said and done.
Philosophy is for lovers.
In the end of the law is love from a pure heart. So, like, there's a...
There is a sense, too, piggybacking on that, which Caldecott does get into, though he doesn't quote him, if I recall, doesn't quote the work. I'm assuming most of you have read Chesterton's The Ethics of Elfland.
Yeah.
Right? The whole point, and that's really neat, the ethics of Elfland, the inextricable link between ethics and awe, ethics and wonder, right?
So you just might mention, for those who haven't read, it's in Orthodoxy.
It is in the book Orthodoxy, right? And he goes to fairy tales as the one of the most formative. He became partly of why he became a Christian was because of the role of fairy tales in his life in awakening the imagination, realizing that fairy tales are there to remind us that we were created to be astonished. We were created to be enthralled. And our culture today, our boutique-oriented, you know, MTV-oriented, movie-oriented culture, is kind of a parody on that. It seeks to enthrall you real quick and then try to do it again with something else. And it will enthrall you if you've got cash. You need money. That's kind of the basis for it. If you don't have any money, they don't care about enthralling you. But what Chesterton says is that fairy tale seems to indicate, you know, when you're reading about rivers flowing with wine, it's supposed to remind you of the astonishment and the awe that you felt when you first realized they flow with water, right? You know, when you read about trees growing candlesticks, it's supposed to remind you of the astonishment when you first realized they grow apples. And he draws this really interesting creation logic kind of distinction there, where he says, you know, you listen to scientists and naturalists, or as he calls it, the spectacles of the skeptic, you know. They come up and they talk about the natural world with the same laws of necessity as the logical world. So two contradictory views cannot possibly both be true. And when I drop this apple, it cannot possibly fall down. And he said, wait a minute, those two aren't the same. See, in fairyland, we always make that distinction. In fairyland, two plus two always equals four. The law of non-contradiction always obtains. But when we let go of apples, they flow upward. You know, and when we go into forests, they have lollipops on the trees. In other words, the world around us is miraculous. It's magnificently miraculous. And we can, and he's got a real eschatological mind, if you think it through.
So Asbury says that his nurse, who told him his fairy tales, is at once the high priestess of wisdom and beauty, I think.
Yeah, wisdom and beauty. And if you start getting students to think in those kind of terms with this awakened moral imagination, Lady Gaga's boring. She really is. I see it every year. She's boring. She's brutish. Oh, sure, okay, I'll watch it. That's kind of neat. The new video's out. Let me check it out. Okay, weird. And that's what I get. I get those kind of reactions. They don't think life is found here. Yeah.
I think your larger point is really good here. And one thing I want to mention, though, about ethics about Elfland, because I think it piggybacks off of what we've been doing, is I think Chesterton's main point is to show that some truths are contingent truths.
Right.
That they're based on observation and sense experience and are not necessary truths of reason,
right,
which is his main point. But I think one of the things that he also does there is he introduces a question about the necessity of generative mechanisms, the necessity of causality. And I just want to point out that I think to go this next step further and to say that God is miraculously making apples fall every time we see the apple fall would be the nominalist move there. I don't think that's... I think for Chesterton, it's a point along his way of thinking. It's an autobiographical development,
right.
I realized this is different than necessary truths, this is contingent truths.
There you go.
But I just want to point out that, man, I realized, wow, that's an interesting nominalist move.
Yeah, nominalist meter. Going.
it was.
To follow up on that, though, would you say, though, even if God has established laws of nature,
yes,
that because he's omniscient and omnipotent, he could be involved in, he's involved in every physical act. He certainly knows of every physical act, and maybe without slipping into voluntarism, he is somehow maybe more personally responsible for everything that happens. I mean, if in him all things hold together, because Chesterton says in the same chapter that perhaps the rising of the sun, he says perhaps it's not a typical natural law, perhaps it's a divine reprise, where all the angels say, this is so lovely, do it again. So maybe the sun comes up every morning because he loves to make the sun come up. It's beautiful, like the child says, do it again, Daddy, do it again, Daddy, do it again, Daddy, read it again, Mommy. And he says, maybe there's a lot of daisies out there because he loves them so much.
Right.
You know, which is, so I'm just wondering if there's a place where there could be laws without, yes, God becoming depersonal.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I don't think it's the depersonalization of God, but I think that, again, it's like the medieval, I think it's a William of Kant says, to say God did it is not an answer. It's not of course God did it as a primary cause, but how did he do it is the question. And then there's the issue, did he use secondary causation of its own integrity? Is there a way to have it?
Yeah, you go ahead.
I would just say, I think that, I mean, your point taken, I think Chesterton is not talking about efficient causality. I think
right,
in the realm,
right,
if you're talking about efficient causality,
right,
then yeah, then don't, exactly, talk about God as a cause. If you're talking about, you know, the purpose of the universe, and you don't talk about God, you're missing the point.
Because that's the issue with beauty, isn't it? The beauty,
yeah,
is from final cause, it's from purpose of the universe. It's not about efficient cause. And I think that's maybe the distinction that I want to
make. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. But the real thing, right, it's ethics of Elfland. And one of the big things for Chesterton, what he found so fascinating, was that by going from this miraculous world, this amazing miraculous creation, to this, you know, mechanistic, naturalistic world of the spectacles of the skeptic, we have lost what he called the conditional ethics of Elfland. The conditional ethics were always summed up by the fairy godmother saying, you know, you must be home from the ball by midnight, or else you're going to turn into a pumpkin, or you know, you must do such and such, or else this is going to happen. And he noticed, you know, never does the character look at the fairy godmother and say, why? How come? And that's because the condition is every bit as fantastic as the reality. Isn't that beautiful? So, and that's what he says, that's what dies in our modern age. Now we're flippant, irreverent, cynical. We could care less because now conditions stifle freedom. So that's really where it's going. That fits right in with that whole idea that God... you know, that children by nature love repetition. And, you know, a child wants you to throw them up over and over until you're just exhausted. And he says it beautifully. He's, you know, Is it perhaps it's not that God is too old? Perhaps he's younger than we are, right? Perhaps God, the sun doesn't just go around in a deistic world. Perhaps God never got tired of saying it. Do it again, do it again. The flowers, perhaps God didn't make all flowers just the same. Perhaps he just never got tired of making it the original way.
I promise I did not tell him how to set up my talk.
Oh, cool. Ka-ching. Roommate.
Yeah.
I just want to suggest that problem is not just a modernist problem. And one of the things that has, as I'm trying to synthesize all of this, I'm thinking back to Lucretius and his attempt to explain the world in terms of atoms. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how often he says, "Do not wonder, O man."
Yep.
And then he gives an explanation. "Do not wonder, O man, at this. Do not wonder at that." And so I don't think that the problem is positing causality. I think the problem is saying causality is sufficient. Right? We have to look past that. We have to look past that to the Creator and stand in awe. Right, and it's that imperative that we try to pull out, where we say, "Do not wonder." That's I think
that's
repressing the truth that is talked about in Romans 1. That's the repression of the truth, is the refusal to wonder.
You're right. That's really cool. And they're just sophists, Epicureans, cynics. They were all short. No question. It's never been a short. When I say it's a modern thing, I said for the first time. It became a worldwide civilization. And that's what we're dealing with. We had Christendom. Christendom for 1,200 years, Byzantium Christendom for 1,200 years. The world, in many respects, was characterized by wonder and awe. Look at its cathedrals, look at its art, look at its music, look at its festivals, look at its calendar, look at its clothing. Look at it. Look at its poetry. And on and on and on you go. It's history, it's politics, it's economics, you name it.
And it's not incidental that modern metaphysics is Lucretian metaphysics. I mean, that what happened with Descartes collapsed metaphysics into atomism.
You got it, and that's it. Yeah.
Lucretius
paid. Yeah, you brought up Werner Jaeger earlier. I mean, he makes this point. You know, a lot of times we look at, like, Plato and Aristotle as if they're the pinnacle of classical civilization, but they're this group who's trying to pick up the pieces in the midst of pragmatist politics and economics and scientism, materialist scientism. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we have a humane, for them, or a soulish kind of,
right.
of education? Yeah, and that's why I think Christians find so much resonance with them, and why we have through the history of the church, like, these people are reacting to the same kind of universe. Yeah, you have, I mean, Lucretius, of course, is translating which Greek? Greek materialist. Like, De Rerum Naturam.
He gets his ideas from Lucifus.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's almost like he puts him in Latin verse. It's almost, he's not a creative thinker at all, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a while since I've been
on that.
Yeah, I mean, so it's that is the background that we find on this kind of education.
May I suggest a turn at this point, just to see where it goes for a few moments? We still have about 40 minutes. There's some grammar school administrators here and the teachers. And, of course, upper school as well. James, who was really good at bridging the gap between philosophy and practice. Here we've been talking about kind of a philosophical approach, pedagogical approach, teaching how to use beauty to teach. I would be very interested in you putting on your classroom educator hats for a few moments. Imagine now that you're doing some planning and you're going to be going into your classes, whatever it is that you teach, in a few days. Based on what you've heard, the presentation yesterday and the presentation we've had so far, what practices, what pedagogies are coming to your minds? Can we brainstorm that for a while? What are the implications of this for your classroom instruction? Would it be okay to do that for about 10 or 15 minutes? I'd like to see how all of you respond now as pedagogues, not just philosophers.
Could I say something kind of to start there? Yeah, I said it half... You know, half joking yesterday, but it was. I guess every joke there's a barb of seriousness, right? The Socratic method wasn't practiced on children. So the resisting of critical modes of education into lower school, I think a lot of times my interaction with grammar school teachers, my own thoughts about training my own children is like to teach classically means to make things hard earlier and have a lot of work. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, the PG map thing. We talked about this. Piety, gymnastic, and music being the foundations of education. And even when you get to the arts, that imitation precedes art. You hear this kind of a slogan in the early world, these early educators. A major pedagogical technique for me would be to resist the critical education and say my primary objective in early childhood education is to work on the imagination, mm-hmm. is to make lovers, right? Make kids who love things. Do your best to foster the imagination. I mean, that means, like, I don't know what that's going to do by this, you know, the standard measures that we have to do on reading and mathematics at young ages and everything like that, but saying, what are these pre-critical imaginative foundations of the arts? And that's what you find, you know, in the tradition.
Historically, the only liberal arts that were taught K through 6 were arithmetic and grammar. That's it.
Well,
everything else, all the other liberal arts were taught later.
And can I give an example of that? Because I think that's dead on. And so in terms of just sort of practice, I found the discussion this morning with John at the end where he sort of went bananas with math to be very interesting. And I was talking with him afterwards, and I said, it seems to me, I mean, we all know that theoretically philosophy begins with wonder, right? But as a sort of practical example of how we would do this, it seems to me like one of the things that too often is missing in Welsh school math education is a sense of wonder. And so we often teach math in the way that it comes across that, look, there's this body of information that we figured out, and you just have to learn it, and you have to learn how to multiply, and you have to learn how to do long division, and you have to learn all this stuff, and then you're going to use it later on, right? But if you can start with these very simple questions, right? Like, why is there no end to prime numbers, right? Little kids can at a fairly young age can latch onto that, right? And it enchants them and gets them engaged in something very dry like mathematics, in a way that excites this sense of wonder and beauty. And, I mean, I think that would be a practical way.
I was saying, my six-year-old heard the word infinity. She's like, well, then what's infinity minus one?
Right, right. No, they're brilliant. That's
right. I'd like to do this just for a few moments. This may not be a great idea, but I'd like to just have everybody else not participate, and let's let the grammar school teachers and administrators here talk, give feedback, ask questions. So we'll just try this for about 5 minutes and see how that goes. I mean, this is a hard thing to do, to make this bridge, but the bridge has to be built. James, you want to offer any introductory comments about this? Because this is kind of where you're
going. Well, I think we're going in the right direction here. And I like what you're doing. I'd love to hear thoughts from that level. And I do agree with Kevin. And I think that even as a movement, we're following the same critical endeavors and analysis that we seek to avoid in a lot of our conversations. And there's a difference between leading with questions and engaging in a critical analyzing through Socratic method that you're talking about. I think it's very, I think it's very natural and very important to ask young kids questions. And you can do that without being critical. And I think one of the things in our movement is that we're producing arrogance and cynicism because we're hypercritical in the way we hold our discussions in our classes. And that what we're dying for are not just questions, but questions accompanied by models that we present to the class, give them time to contemplate, give them time for that wonder to kick in. And that's why I like the book, The Leisure Basis of Culture. I think leisure is the basis of schooling, where we get the word scola from schooling from scola. And that we need to offer more models for contemplation and give them time to do that. And so I like all the conversations that
and
I have.
If I can even, in terms of what was brought into, when I use the Lady Gaga example, the best students that are able to respond to this are students that have had several years of beautiful and good and lovely music in their background. Mm-hmm. So then it's not just this, let's rip apart the secular age.
Right.
And just be a bunch of cranky fundamentalists here. We're talking about ripping apart a modern age that we really feel is sick. There's no life there because we've already found life somewhere else, and we feel it and we love it. And that's what you're trying to awaken a love for Christian culture.
But let's hear from Mark Grammer. Thank you, Steve. This is all excellent. I agree. Let's hear from Jeff and Bill and absolutely and Jennifer.
I'm just gonna die.
Cut her off, Chris. Cut her
fifth
off.
Fifth grade educator, right?
Okay, I have been teaching grammar level kids for 15 years, and I have a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old. And what I see happening in this movement right now is something a little dangerous. It is that top-down thinking that we've been doing, where we start with rhetoric and we move down to the grammar, and we think about what kind of rhetorical skills do we need to start inculcating in them in the early years. We get into a fantasy world, if you will, where we look at our own children, who are automatically much brighter than the average child, and we latch on to certain questions that they ask that seem to indicate this unbelievable depth of understanding, because it does in us, it may not in them. And then from that, we say, in the classroom, we must allow them to have this freedom of thinking and this freedom of expression that will unbelievably transform them. Now, what you are doing is exactly what mainstream education has done over the last 20 or 30 years. They said, we are limiting children by teaching them math facts and dates of wars and people who are important and who's to decide what's important, and all these dates and things are stupid. Let's get them really thinking. So what they did is they moved all the critical thought down to the lower school, and they wrote curriculums based on, tell me your thinking. When you do 2 plus 2 equals 4, what does that mean? And this child in my classroom is crying because he doesn't know what it means and he doesn't care. He just wants to do it. Just tell me what to do, Mrs. Cable. Just tell me what to do. So because they can do it sometimes does not mean that it is the right thing for us to have them do it all the time. Yes, they can ask questions, but no, they're not ready for that. They need experience with the true, the good, and the beautiful. I'm in the process of writing an extensive Bible curriculum. I decided to include art from the Renaissance. I know nothing about it, but I can tell you I can't even get my Bible lesson done because they want to know
Absolutely.
About the picture. And they want to know, why is he dressed that way, and why is he
Absolutely.
Holding that up, and why is that book there? And I have no idea, so I've already just ordered a whole bunch more books I have to read and learn. So they are attracted to those things. And at that age, they should be. And we should encourage that. And I should tell them the grammar of the picture and the painting. Well, back then they believed this symbolized this, and this symbolized this, and this. If I take the time to tell them that I want to hear their esoteric vision of reality, we are going to spend an hour talking about something that may be very gratifying to me as a rhetorical level person, but gives them nothing. There might be two kids in that class that get what we're talking about, and the rest die. That's what mainstream education has done. That's why they're getting nothing accomplished with kids. Because all they do all the time is waste time talking about things that most kids don't get. Please, let us not make that mistake.
Bill, here we go. Thank you. Bill, let's hear from you, or Jeff.
I feel like you just talked to yourself all the way through the whole thing, which is wonderful. Because we don't want to drive them to tears with, what do you think about 2 plus 2 equals 4? But we want to lead them to say, what is infinity minus 1? Because that's where the magic happens. When they're saying, what is infinity minus 1? Now we have the conversation. You were saying, too, they do wonder anyway. What I liked about the book is how it tied in music and math so much. I mean, I already knew that because I understand both, but that where math and music come together, you can't separate them, so let's bring them together and let's show them that. And
yes, but you know what? Showing them those things doesn't mean you have to expostulate on them.
Yeah.
You know, I taught. talk to them about Fibonacci's number.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, get rid of that. Like, pull that critical education out.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, I'm showing them why does the area of a circle work. Let's make it into its pie pieces and rearrange them. So you show them that, but let's not sit down and have a Socratic discussion about it. You know?
I think what you have is there's been a line of drill and kill in the lower school, in a lot of schools. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing now is a lot of schools are, what I would say, maturing and saying there's something more than just getting a kid to memorize.
You mean classical
schools? In classical schooling. There's something more than just getting a kid to memorize and that be it. And we've had trouble in school, a lot of schools, with kids just memorizing. When they get to the logic stage, they can't think. They just want to memorize what's on the test.
So you may hear an
emphasis on this wonder and things like that because of the background that a lot of people have had in that.
Well, the problem is we're not differentiating between lower grammar, upper grammar. And that's one of the things I'm working on right now is figuring out how does methodology change in the upper grammar that leads them into logic without dumping them.
Well, and lower logic versus upper logic,
exactly.
And lower rhetoric versus
exactly.
upper rhetoric. Yes. I mean, the mistake we make is we've made as a whole the movement, and I'm not incriminating everyone, but I'm saying in a general sense, where we've made a mistake is that we've said grammar, during the grammar school years, you only do grammar.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And that's what you're talking about. And I think now, I think people are starting to realize that even kindergartners, with every grammar component they do, there is a logic and a rhetoric component to it as well.
Can we do this? Listen, I want to get to you, but I just like want to hear from the two other grammar school educators, make sure they're putting their thoughts on the table, and then we'll just open it up to philosopher and pedagogue alike. So, Bill, and then I'd love to hear from Pam.
I would be willing to defer to Andrew because I think I know where he might be going based on the conversation we had last night.
Okay, Andrew?
Well, I'm dying to speak to this because I don't think we've defined the grammar of mathematics properly. I think we've grossly misdefined it. All right. So to say that the grammar of